And welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. It's happened to the best of them. Great directors with critically acclaimed movies to their names, and then they go out and make a flop of a film, a total bomb that's a disaster at the box office. As I said, it happens to the best of them. Today, our DVD gurus will walk us through films by Michael Mann, Steven Spielberg, Clint Eastwood, and others, and with each, we'll ask the same question: what were they thinking? The DVD gurus are Mitch Bryan, who's a screenwriter, UMKC film prof, and writer for 435 South. Mitch, welcome back.
Great to be here.
Also here is film critic Jason Heck. Jason, how are you?
I'm very well. Thank you for asking.
With so many much money on the line here, so many millions of dollars, and with so many people involved, you know, in the making of any one film, Mitch, you know, sometimes you wonder, how can anybody truly turn out a turkey these days?
How can anybody not these days? Because you just – William Goldman said in Adventures in the Screen Trade, nobody knows anything. And so every one of these movies, for one reason or another, the belief was that the film was going to do well. Now, some got out of control. Some didn't. Some were poorly marketed. And it's part of what makes the movie industry so interesting. It's, of course, the thing that the studios today are doing their very, very best to try and avoid. I can understand that from a business point of view.
Yeah.
But it's much more fun when studios are really taking risks, mm-hmm. as opposed to deciding that Battleship is the right
another
source material
movie.
For a movie, right, right. And it bombs. It's like, who cares? Right?
Well, Jason, that's interesting what Mitch just said, that nobody knows anything. That's really true about the making of a film, right? I mean, the actors and actresses themselves, they don't really know when they complete shooting if they've got a good film in their hands or not a lot of times.
In theory, only a couple people really know about the overarching film, the overarching vision of the film. And I think there's also an issue with a couple of these movies, but with movies in general now, that very much too many cooks spoil the soup. So you have a lot of interference. You have a couple of these. We have actually all of our films today. All of them are directors who are immensely talented and had big, good track records going into these movies. Mm-hmm. Well, with one exception, but his first film was spectacular and everybody thought it was great. So you have a lot of faith and a lot of well, these guys are great and they're. We can't possibly go wrong with these guys. And sure enough, when you start getting nervous and, well, maybe we're not so sure, then the studio starts interfering and budgets start getting looked at mm-hmm. and directors start chafing under authority and things can just go wildly off the rails.
And interestingly enough, all of these movies that we're talking about were films that were made during this period where the directors had extraordinary control mm-hmm. over their movies. And so we're talking about that kind of second golden age of cinema that started in more 68 and went up through the mid 80s, at least in terms of directors having power and control and being the ones who are really driving the project. And prior to that, you know, the studios were in charge. And now in the wake of several of these big bombs, the corporations are back in control and therefore the corporations are run by the marketing department.
And Jason, the film industry is suffering as a result, at least in terms of quality of the films.
Do you really want to see another Transformers movie? Do you care about another Spider-Man
Somebody
movie?
Somebody does, yeah.
Obviously. And the market, of course, the summer market is allegedly what young men under 25 has always sort of been what these movies are geared toward. Some of them have pretensions to smarts, this new Captain America, The Winter Soldier, people talked about, you know, oh, it's relevant. It talks about digital surveillance and all this. But really, it's just a little bit better than the other superhero movies out there. It's not going to rewrite the book on it. So, yeah, it's all Sony and Marvel and these huge conglomerates that look at movies simply as product. Mm-hmm. Now, okay, fine. MGM looked at movies as product in 1940, but it's kind of different. It's more corporate ease. It's more focus group to death. And obviously you go with sure things. Godzilla is sort of one of the only movies this summer that actually feels original, but it's not original. It's just because it's not a superhero movie and it's not a sequel and it's not a franchise picture. Mm. It'll probably become a franchise. But, you know, Godzilla went back to 1954 or something, so it's not really original. Hmm. Nothing really feels that original in summer movies anymore. So when something that is original, like, say, what is something original? Inception. Okay, mm-hmm. So Inception feels like something brand new and happens to make $700 million. Well, that gets everybody's attention.
Mm-hmm.
And Inception was a truly unique film to me. I thought it was conceptually really, really great. And it wasn't a superhero movie, and it wasn't.
And it only got made because the director was coming off of the very popular Batman movies and kind of said, you know, if you want me to keep me happy and keep me doing these things, yeah, let me do this thing that's – and they were really nervous about Inception because they couldn't point to – a board game or a TV show or something that it was inspired by, you know?
Wow. Right. Wow. Next summer we can look forward to Sorry and Chutes and Ladders, which should I think are both budgeted north of $200 million, but it should be incredible.
Mitch and Jason this morning are talking about directors who make flops of films and what happens and why it happens. Is there one director who's known as the king of the flop, Mitch?
I don't think so. They would probably be
they wouldn't be around
in director's jail, I think.
Yeah. Another flop.
Yeah.
Hmm. Yeah. I'm trying to think of somebody who keeps – well.
But, you know, it is interesting that if a director has enough successes, you know, they buy the director a few flops. And I would point to somebody like Walter Hill, who is a terrific director and had several hits, not only producing Alien and then, you know, directed 48 Hours, which was a huge hit. And you know, his latter – works are probably not as strong as mm-hmm. the earlier works, but you know, he has built a brand and a reputation, and people let him continue to make films.
Woody Allen a little bit in that sense, kind of coasting.
Yeah, but
on.
But you know, he was, but Midnight in Paris was a monster hit, and that and he has always been a director who has made movies on time, on budget. He's made one a year.
Even if they don't make money, you're not going to lose too much
there's
money.
There's never any surprises mm-hmm. with a Woody Allen movie. In fact, he even budgets in reshoots so that if he needs to go back and do extra stuff, it's part of his business. He's got it's an extraordinary business model.
You know, afterwards, do these guys, Jason, tend to acknowledge ever that, yeah, they put out a turkey?
Well, some do, some don't. I remember most of these guys have monumental egos.
I was just going to say.
Michael Mann, who directed The Keep, which came out in 1983, he has enough power and enough distaste for the movie that it has never been released on DVD. He will guarantee this one man will roadblock that movie ever coming out on DVD. Spielberg referred to 1941 as, quote, an absolute horror. But this was about 20 years ago. Since then, he's given his own work a critical reappraisal and feels that it's a little bit better than it was given credit for.
And even released a director's cut, which is the only version you can see now, which is longer. That's just what that movie needs.
Oh, you're kidding. Really? Yeah.
Mitch and I actually watched it, and it was a slog. We kept looking over at the counter on the Blu-ray player and sort of looking at each other just in awe. Wow, we just hit 2 hours. Wow, we're at 2.5 hours. And it's a slog. So
wow.
These guys, you know, they don't get to where they are without having unbelievable egos and unbelievable confidence in themselves. And so
that's your story.
I wouldn't be in this chair if I didn't have the ego to match. So, you know, so in Eastwood, you know, who is a brand? Eastwood is Clint Eastwood, capital C, capital E. So when he gets something like Hereafter, which is, I mean, not a good movie at all. He's going to shrug it off, and he's targeted for this. He's targeted. He's got a new film coming out next year, American Sniper, huge biography of this Navy SEAL sniper who had 255 kills.
Yeah,
and
we talked to him once.
Bradley Cooper.
On the show. Yeah.
It's going to be huge. So Eastwood just keeps shrugging him off because every other movie he does is kind of a good movie that makes money.
And I should add that, at least speaking personally, I have a soft spot for all of these movies we're talking about today, except maybe one. And even then, I can find something good about it. So, you know, we've never been the guys who come on here and trash movies because we love movies so much. And so these are all, I think, worth a look. I think every single one of the movies we talk about today, if you're a film fan or you're interested in cinema, they are totally interesting examples.
It's totally true because when we emerged from Mitch's Man Cave movie theater after watching 1941 – he pointed to me and said, "You actually liked a lot of that movie, didn't you?" And a lot of it made me laugh. I can see why it was not nearly what anybody thought it could be or should be. I can see where it got bloated and awful, but I also laughed a lot during the movie. So, who knows?
Well, if our listeners have nominations for films made by great directors that turned out to be horrific flops, we're all ears. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Again, 816-235-2888. Sergio has already written us at UpToDate@KCUR.org to say, I would say that M. Night Shyamalan could be in the running for the king of flops.
That's totally valid. M. Night Shyamalan coasted. He exploded out of the gate with The Sixth Sense. He hit a couple of doubles and has struck out on every single movie.
Signs
since.
Was huge, though. Wasn't
Signs was a double.
I've never heard of that.
But in terms of quality, I mean, it wasn't, you know. Yeah. But everything else after, I'd say, probably after Signs.
After
it
Signs.
Started, and then The Village turned out to be kind of a lame gimmick that was real. I mean, all of his movies are essentially stretched out Twilight Zone episodes. But when the hook at the end of the Twilight Zone isn't that compelling, then the whole episode feels wasted. Yeah. And that's kind of. And then he started getting this enormous ego and writing himself into his movies to play these. In Lady in the Water, he plays this sort of Christ-like character. And, you know, the one of the people who gets killed in a horrible, goofy way in Lady in the Water is a movie critic. So that's him lashing out at critics in his movies. And he just got this huge ego. And now he's just a gun for hire, making awful movies like that Will Smith thing, After Earth. Oh. He's he can't really move his own projects anymore, with good reason.
Okay, Sergio, I hope that helps a little bit. Let's move on to today's list. And, Mitch Bryan, you want to talk about The Day of the Dolphin from Mike Nichols, 1973.
Nichols, who had, you know, The Graduate is still one of the great American movies, and Mike Nichols is one of, you know, the great American directors. He's made so many terrific films. Very few turkeys in the bunch.
But this one qualifies. Yeah.
And yet, it's fascinating. So the premise is essentially, it's based on a French novel that was called The Sentient Animal, and George C. Scott plays a marine biologist who has taught a dolphin how to talk. And so he is with the foundation, the Franklin Foundation, a sinister corporation funding him. This is 1973, so we're at the height of the paranoid spy thriller. They adapt this satire novel into a very straight thriller. Buck Henry writes the screenplay. And at the end of the day, it's about a talking dolphin being kidnapped and trained to assassinate the president of the United States.
My goodness. It
boggles the mind.
Issue number one right there, maybe.
$8.5 million, which was a lot of money in 1973.
Funny thing, it still is.
It's still a lot of money to you and me, but to the movies, that's nothing. Nobody makes movies for $8 million anymore.
Yeah.
So it was expensive. It was hard to make. But if you watch the film, the weird thing about it is that every scene individually kind of works. It's beautifully photographed by William Fraker, gorgeous score by George Delarue. But at the end of the day, it's about a couple of talking dolphins, and it just gets ludicrous after a certain point.
How ludicrous does it get?
Well, the wait till you hear the clip, because you know it's pretty good. Because it is that shadowy corporation, and the clip will be the key members of a shadowy corporation interviewing the dolphin, if you can believe that.
Are we going to hear the dolphin speak?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and you're going to hear it form words that no dolphin could possibly. I mean, you know, lips to wrap around these words.
Why would they? This is.
Now, when I saw the movie, I think I was in fifth or sixth grade, and for a fifth or sixth grade kid, it was really something.
I remember watching it with my mom.
It was even kind of adult because it had this very straight, you know, sinister, paranoid vibe to it. But then I saw it when I was a little bit older, and it didn't have the same – it had a different appeal. You know?
Okay, we're going to make some up-to-date history here. For the first time in the history of this program, we are now going to hear a dolphin speak.
That's right.
This is a clip from The Day of the Dolphin, the director of this turkey, Mike Nichols.
I wonder if we could hear that again, Dr. Terrell.
Yes, sir.
Well, I'll say again.
Man is good.
Why does he believe that, do you suppose? Man is good.
Ask him.
May I? Far?
Far.
Why is man good?
Smooth.
I didn't get that, I'm afraid.
Smooth. He says we're smooth as he is. He likes the way we feel.
Also, it is less a philosophical judgment than a physiological one.
Well, to Alpha, smoothness is pleasure, and pleasure is good. I think that's a reasonable beginning for a philosopher, don't you?
Isn't the shark also smooth? Does that make him good? What about the shark? What does he say?
I'm afraid he doesn't understand what you're saying. Your accent makes it difficult.
That's bad.
It's the accent. Otherwise, he would have answered the question.
Yeah, and if you're going to make a dolphin speak, it would sound like that. That is just silly.
And that's Buck Henry, the screenwriter, doing the voice for the dolphin.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, isn't that awesome? So it's a movie that was very expensive. The producer claimed that he had pre-sold enough money to cover the budget. That being said, nobody really went and saw the picture. And the critics fell on it with, sharpened knives. And
really?
If you have a chance, you can get your Netflix maybe put it on there.
Folks, if you could see him shrugging and hemming and hawing right now, you'd know exactly how qualified that recommendation is.
Okay, flops by directors who should have known better. That's our topic today. Your recommendations, welcome. 816-235-2888 is our number here. Mitch and Jason are in the house. Let's go to Frank from Lawrence. Frank, you're on Up to Date.
Hi, good morning. Yeah, I don't really have a flop to nominate, but what I was going to mention is what the two guys here have been talking about, and a friend of mine in Kansas City who goes to movies, and sometimes she thinks she saw basically a flop, and what I said and what I believe you guys agree with, and I'll let you answer the question, that no matter how bad a movie is, there are parts of it that are interesting to watch, maybe that stand out. I'll take the your comments off the air, but let me know what you think, because you already said that, I believe.
Yeah, interesting thoughts. Always something that's maybe worth watching, even if it is a turkey.
Except maybe Anchorman 2. I'm not sure. I was trying to find something in there, and I couldn't find anything in that.
Yeah, that was the great, most hyped film in the history of Hollywood.
Was it awful.
That thing fell off the table faster than...
Brutal.
It was, shatteringly unfunny.
Yeah.
Every stupid little cameo that they brought in to try and redeem it, I just stared, and I felt myself getting stupider. Like I forgot my piano lessons. Yeah. I forgot multiplication tables.
Your brain cells dying.
And I sort of staggered out and kind of gripped the shoulder of the guy in front of me, and he kind of mumbled, it's okay, I know the way out. And he led me out, and the fresh air kind of cleared my head, but Anchorman 2 nearly destroyed me. Very nearly.
Wow. But to our caller's point, that there's always something
in the
worth
movies
redeeming.
That we've picked. Yeah. Absolutely, there, and that's why we picked them. With one kind of exception that rhymes with The Rookie, there's something pretty redeeming in these movies. Or you can say, "Wow, I get what he was trying to do." Yeah. I get, or there are some laughs, or there's some beauty to be found. But
I have one nice thing to say about The Rookie, but you have to wait for that.
Yeah.
There's a reason to live, right? reason number 409. Yeah, okay.
Fight your way out of the coma, Kraske.
Jason Heck, let's talk about The Keep from Michael Mann. Nazis are forced to turn to a Jewish historian for help in battling the ancient demon they have inadvertently freed from its prison. That's
well, I guess
premise.
I don't need to talk about it now, Steve Kraske.
There you go.
It is, folks. You don't even need to see it. From Michael Mann, who has, of course, become famous for cool, moody crime thrillers.
Miami Vice.
Who gave us Miami Vice. Michael Mann debuted with an extraordinarily skillful and good film called Thief with James Caan in 1981. It was not really seen by too many people. Now,
there is a beautiful new Blu-ray transfer of it. If you've not seen Thief, go watch
it. Run,
that
Don't
one.
Walk. It's an incredibly good movie.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm writing it down.
And he had not yet gotten sort of categorized as this guy who does gray morality against nighttime cityscapes. And he decided to pick as his next project this very pulpy gothic horror film, horror book from 1981 called The Keep. And what we have here is a movie that really falls into two camps. You have Michael Mann with his very art house kind of pretensions, and you have pulpy horror. And because of that, he's so busy making beautiful images that he doesn't sink his teeth into the horror. He can't make it genuinely horrifying. I get that what grabbed him about the book was the morality tale, was the call it the ideological scope, call it the fact of, a parable for Nazis and supernatural, which is something worse than the Nazis, and the Nazis have to turn to a Jew to help them. I get that all that. He loved the bigger ideas. He didn't bite. And so that's why he left a lot of the novel out of the picture. Now, the movie is nearly incomprehensible. Truly. No, you look at it and you wonder, oh, my God, what's happening here? It's at the height of MTV video is sort of really becoming an art form. So you have a lot of really strong backlighting and a lot of smoke, and it looks like a high-end music video in a lot of scenes. Performances are interesting. You have Jürgen Prochnow as the sort of humane head of the regular German army who's trying to garrison this keep and whose soldiers keep getting slaughtered. You have Gabriel Byrne as this SS guy who comes in to try and root out what are believed to be partisans. They kind of do German accents. Then you have the Romanians who kind of do flat Californian accents. And they're all played by American actors. And they wrap their Robert Prosky, as this priest, has to wrap his mouth around some of the most incredible Romanian verbiage and names that you've ever heard in this very flat American inflection. Then we have Scott Glenn as this supernatural warrior who comes in out of nowhere. Scott Glenn is asked to be this sort of guy who's – his main gimmick is that his eyes glow when he asserts his supernatural power. And that's pretty much it.
Boy.
So the and last but not least, the Jewish scholar who is brought in is played by Ian McKellen. Now, Ian McKellen has gone on to become one of the best-known British thespians in America thanks to being a part in two of the biggest franchises in recent memory with Lord of the Rings and the X-Men. He is an extraordinarily talented actor and given to histrionics as Gandalf and Magneto and big shouting, huge scenes and – and he sort of gets to do that in The Keep. Now,
my goodness.
We can say the main problem with The Keep is that it's 96 minutes. Michael Mann's original cut was 3.5 hours.
Wow.
He assembled
it
what
he... It got chopped from 3.5 hours to 96 minutes?
Right. His vision, his what he made a comprehensible film that told a story he wanted to tell was 3.5 hours.
My.
So when
a version which nobody has seen.
No one has ever seen it. And Mann bragged. He bragged about the verisimilitude and the great locations. And the locations are great. It's this Romanian village is built in a quarry in Wales. And it has these huge walls on either side, these great stone walls. It's really – it's a beautiful movie to look at. It's so pretty. And so it's such a colossal failure. It doesn't tell a story that you care about. Mm-hmm. The villain is poorly developed.
How can you do that? How can you – and not have someone weigh in, you know, someone with some authority to, and tell Michael Mann, you got to be kidding me at 3.5 hours, much
someone
less
did.
96 minutes.
Someone did.
Yeah.
And the studio said, look, we can't release this movie. No one knows who you are. It stars a German actor that no one's heard of. There's nothing here that's going to make this movie a box office draw.
Yeah.
So what we can do is at least we can get it to play twice in one night instead of once. So we're going to chop it to 96 minutes. That's essentially what they did.
My God.
Had no power. He was not the Michael Mann of today. So it was very easy for them to do.
What's the clip we have here from The Keep? Do we need to hear a clip?
We're going to hear a clip. Okay, so we have Ian McKellen as Dr. Kuza, and the monster of The Keep, this entity called Molossar, has healed him. He was in a wheelchair. And in return for healing him, the monster wants him to remove this talisman from The Keep, which will allow him to be free, and Molossar can run off and kill Hitler, which is what kind of the his bribe to McKellen has been. But McKellen pauses when Molossar says, you have to kill your daughter because she's going to stop you from trying to get out. And we have Ian McKellen and the monster having a big face-off. He's popping some sass at the monster is what we have here.
From The Keep.
Who are you that I have to prove myself to by killing my child? A baby! Return to the diseased state I found you in. And I'll slay both of you. If this is yours, as you said, then you take it out of the keep. You can't? Then this isn't yours. And the keep is a prison to contain you. And you have lied, exploited, deceived. And you are the same evil as outside this place. So you prove yourself to me. You take it out of here. You yourself. Take it! Take it!
I can't take it anymore. That's from The Key from Michael Mann. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about some more flops made by great directors. We want you to tweet us your picks of the worst films by the best directors. Just tweet us at KCUR up to date. Coming up, we'll get to Zardoz and The Rookie, Heaven's Gate, 1941, and others too. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And we're back, and that's from which film?
The Dolphin.
David Dolphin.
Beautiful
okay.
score.
Yeah. If you missed our conversation about tornado chasers, you can find that in our weekend to-do list. Just go to kcur.org. Monday on the show, psychologist Wes Crenshaw is back. He'll talk about teaching kids the value of money in a heavily consumer culture. That's Monday on the show. This hour, Mitch Bryan and Jason Hecker here, our DVD gurus. We're talking about great films or lousy films made by great directors. Let's move on here, Mitch, to Zardoz, John Boorman. 1974.
So I have a confession. I really love Zardoz. It makes me happy. But the critics didn't agree with me.
It makes you happy.
It makes me happy. Any movie with Sean Connery running around in an orange diaper with bandoleros across his chest.
My goodness. You know,
makes me happy now that I think about it.
Yeah, it's pretty good,
like
right?
Like dolphins talking.
And a floating stone head that is their god. It's a futuristic movie that was made by John Boorman. And you know, it was made for $1.5 million, not a very expensive picture, and it made about that back, you know, so not counting prints and ads, it was, you know, it was probably close, it was a little bit of a loss, but the critics just hated it, and it has become kind of a cult film, and it's a movie that is brimming with ideas, probably more ideas than it needs to have, but it is not a film that lacks ambition.
And that's typically the problem, right? Too many ideas for a film. That's what can take a film and send it off the tracks.
Sometimes,
right?
Either
yeah.
that or no ideas.
Yeah, in
I
the
mean,
case of Heaven, in the case
no
of
Heaven's
ideas. Gate,
okay.
not enough ideas to fill 3.5 hours. But I think that what, you know, Boorman still speaks warmly of the film, and he was at this place where, having come off of Deliverance, which was this monster hit and which is still maybe one of the most perfect films ever made, he had been spending time working on an adaptation of The Lord of the Rings, which didn't happen. He had not yet written the script for what would become Excalibur. So he was in this kind of mythical place, and he concocts this story, this science fiction story that's set in the year 2293, and society has been divided into two groups, one group called the Immortals, who live forever and who are sheltered away from the rest of the world, and the other group called the Brutals, who have normal lifespans. And among the Brutals are this group of killers and terrorizers called the Exterminators, and they worship a great stone floating head named Zardoz that gives them guns. And Sean Connery is called Zed, and he is one of the Exterminators. He sneaks into the head and is secretly transported back into the land of the Immortals, where he finds out that this head is a big experiment by one of their crazy renegade scientists. And he ultimately brings the gift of death to this stagnant society where people live forever and therefore they don't procreate, and if you commit a crime, you're aged until you become senile, and then they put you off in a community of old people by yourself. And so it is really a film it's totally surreal. It's very trippy. We're talking about a movie that was made in 1974, and there's parallels with drug culture and hippie culture. And Sean Connery, who had was not going to play James Bond anymore, goes off and he's making movies that are about as far from 007 as you can get.
Yeah.
And he is great in this movie. He is totally male and visceral and committed, and it's a great performance. And it is just one of the weirdest movies you'll ever see in your life.
What's the clip we have here?
So he has
found Zardoz.
From Zardoz. He has found his way, Connery's character has found his way into the community of the immortals who have been aged because of crime. So they're now senile, all living together, and they all wish they could just die. And the leader rallies the old people together to tell them who is the Sean Connery is here.
All right.
Now hear this, you old farts. Meet this creature from the outside world.
Huh?
This man
has
the gift of death.
Death?
He can mete it out, and he can die himself. He's mortal.
He can die.
Shall we give him back to death?
Yes!
Silent death?
Yes!
Glorious death?
Yes!
May the scientists want him to spawn another generation to suffer our agonies.
Okay.
Great radio. Great radio consistently today with these clips.
Yeah, there you go. Let's go to some phone calls here. Great directors who made terrible films. Ladd from Overland Park, good morning.
Good morning.
Hi.
Hi. I was going to say Terry Gilliam, and I'll defend myself with that. I really think that, like, Tideland, which didn't get seen by a lot of people, Brothers Grimm, which was more, kind of more mainstream, and then Dr. Parnassus was all kinds of squirrely, and that was like one of Heath Ledger's last performances. But I mean, Terry Gilliam's one of those directors who set like such an incredibly high bar for himself, like with every outing, that even when he fails, like with his Don Quixote adaptation, it's worth noting. So I would say, even though those movies are like not that great in my estimation, there's parts of them that are interesting. So I would kind of crop them in with that. A lot of great directors who have made flops, but they're still worth it on their own merits.
Absolutely. Always a master visualist, and Lost in La Mancha is one of the most interesting movie documentaries I've ever seen.
Yeah, I'm with you there, definitely.
Absolutely. Brazil is one of my favorites of all time, bar none.
Oh, yeah. That movie, I've seen it maybe four or five times, and it just gets better every time. But again, he's like one of those directors that set such an impossibly high bar for himself early on that anything else has just been, feels like, even his new one, Zero Theorem, I read like a poor review of that on the Guardian website. Even that feels a little bit derivative of Brazil.
They can't all be time bandits.
Ladd, thank you for the call. I appreciate it. Jason Heck, let's move on to a film you've already panned, which is The Rookie from Clint Eastwood, 1990. Yeah.
All right. So Eastwood is interesting. My last two films, we have critic reviews. And this one comes from Gene Siskel of the Chicago Tribune, who says, quote, "It's a very depressing experience. Everyone is wasted in the film." Now, Eastwood is interesting. He has made some extraordinary films. Let's look at Mystic River. Let's look at Outlaw Josie Wales. Let's look at even Play Misty for Me is great, and Letters from Iwo Jima. And then he's made Bloodwork, Firefox, Heartbreak Ridge, Absolute Power, J. Edgar. Wow. He has a tendency to sink into laziness. Now, The Rookie is from 1990, and Eastwood was... he's probably 60, late 50s, I think, in 1990. So he sees the world passing Dirty Harry by. Okay. It was 3 years since the last Dirty Harry picture, The Deadpool, which was a failure. He sees that all these young pups like Mel Gibson and whatnot are making mints doing buddy cop pictures. So why can't he? And he's Clint Eastwood, so who's going to say no? So Eastwood goes out and spends $6 and buys arguably the worst script ever written and makes one of the laziest, dullest, most... And it really is, for all the mayhem, it's a shockingly inert motion picture that has two German villains. So let's cast Puerto Rican and Brazilian to play those villains. So we've got Raul Julia and Sonia Braga as the leaders of this car theft ring. And we've got Charlie Sheen, who is coming off of some pretty hot roles and who is deep into substance abuse. So Clint Eastwood thinks he can be a father figure and General Charlie Sheen into sobriety. And they make this movie that starts off with a bang and is a prolonged whimper thereafter. It is horrifyingly assembled from cliches. It has almost nothing really redeeming in it. Mitch and I watched it and were shocked at how boring it was, but how sloppy Eastwood is. And that's the thing to remember about Eastwood. Mitch told me something amazing. Eastwood is, he rolls on rehearsals. That's how quick he is as a director. And he's okay with shooting, with getting a mediocre take with a slightly bobbled line if he can just keep doing his thing and keep moving that day and get all his shots in. So he'll do two takes, and the director might say, you know, Clint, I have a better one in me. No, we've got it. So you're left with takes that are clearly bobbled. Eastwood directing himself, he plays this the gimmick is he's an old fart cop, a grouch named Nick Polovsky, who is on the auto theft squad, and Charlie Sheen is this young rich kid cop who is fighting the ghost of his long dead brother, who he sort of killed maybe when they were playing, and a rich father who wants him out of the force. Wow. And he's Eastwood's partner, and they're going after these Germans played by Puerto Ricans and Brazilians. And it is really one of the worst movies I've ever seen. And it's Eastwood. It made no money. It made like $21 million in 1990, and it cost north of, I think it cost around 30. So it was a flop. And then Eastwood, you know, would go on to do great movies. He'd go on to do Million Dollar Baby and Mystic River and all these others. But
Mitch, you see no redeeming qualities in this film either?
I think the score by Lenny Niehaus is great. And Jack Green's photography is about as dark as possible and yet is beautiful. So it is a really interesting movie to look at. But you just turn –
Great car chase opening, this thing where Eastwood's police car is chasing.
I love car chases.
Well, it is. It's a great chase, and it was shot at night. It was done by Bill Young's Precision Driving Team, who are sort of this assembly of great stunt drivers. And it's Eastwood is chasing a car transporter loaded with exotic cars that have all been stolen. And they start the crooks start dropping the cars to try and knock him off the road. And it ends in this spectacular crash, which Eastwood – he gives up on because he staggers out and delivers this funny comic line and then passes out. Eastwood, here's the thing about the movie. It's humorless. That's what you have to know about
Eastwood. And yet every attempt at humor falls completely flat. So that's what makes it humorless.
He's not a funny guy in general. His movies are generally – I mean, he's done a few. But this one is so – it's you just look – I glance over at Mitch, and it's sort of like looking at a car wreck that just keeps happening. And it's like, wow, I can't believe it hit another car.
What's the clip we have here from the rookie from Clint Eastwood?
This is so great. This is Charlie Sheen. He has gone to his rich father for ransom money because Eastwood's character has been kidnapped by the Puerto Rican Germans. And he has gone to his father for $2 million worth of ransom, and they're going to hash out in 30 seconds of dialogue all of his childhood trauma. It's amazing.
You continue making mistakes, and I have to spend the rest of my life paying for them.
A man is going to die. I didn't come to you because you're my father. I came to you because you're the richest person that I know.
Do you think you're punishing now?
Putting yourself out in the street where you could get maimed or killed? I've already lost one son. You can't know how that feels. He was my brother. You're my only son. It's your responsibility to be here for us.
Oh, my responsibility? Where were you when I was in pain? Where were you when I was hurting?
I've always given you everything you wanted. But you were never there for me, Dad.
A lot of cliches in
that
amazing,
one. It's amazing, but they fixed it. They sorted it all out.
Cliches, cliches, cliches. That's from The Rookie from Clint Eastwood made back in 1990. We're talking this morning with Jason and Mitch about great directors making lousy films and why all that tends to happen. Our phone number here, 816-235-2888 for your recommendations. If you want to tweet us your pick for the worst film by the best director that you've ever come across, at KCUR Up to Date is the place to do it. Mitch Bryan, how about a movie that got more attention for being a flop than perhaps any film that I've come across in a long time? Heaven's Gate by Michael Cimino from 1980.
Yeah, it's a movie that we can see as a significant sea change for the movie industry in a lot of ways. It was the movie where it was such a big disaster that they definitely moved away from the idea of the director being allowed to go out and just make his film without anybody getting in the way.
This was the dividing point.
This
here,
was
this
also
film.
The one of the first movies where the press was so they'd gotten a taste of this. There'd been blood in the water after Apocalypse Now, and everybody was writing about it, calling it Apocalypse When and Apocalypse Never. And so we started seeing this trend.
I like that film.
It's a great film.
Yeah.
It's a great film, and it ultimately, you know, made its money back and everything else, but it, controversial. And so the press started to really get into this idea of sort of covering the movie before it ever even came out. And of course, now every week we get the – what were the top five movies in the box office? I mean the public is very attuned to this, and they really weren't prior to Heaven's Gate. So it was a movie that everybody was reading about and hearing about. And by the time – it's a movie that started out with at a budget of $7.5 million, which – at the time, was the kind of money getting close to the kind of money you would spend on your big tentpole movies. The UA was looking for a $10 million budgeted blockbuster type of film, which this was not. And they knew that. They knew this was going to be their prestige movie at $7.5 million, but they decided they were going to roll the dice on it. Unfortunately, the budget swelled to $44 million by the time this picture was done.
$44 million from 17.
The first day of shooting, apparently, according to Stephen Bock's book, Final Cut, which is a terrific book about the history of United Artists and, of course, the destruction of United Artists in the wake of Heaven's Gate, maintains that on the first day, and he was a production executive on the film, on the first day of shooting, Cimino shot 60,000 feet of film for about 1.5 minutes of usable footage and was 5 days behind schedule on the first day. So this picture ultimately gets – the first cut was 5.5 hours long. It gets cut down to 3 hours and 29 minutes, which was the premiere version that was run at what is arguably one of the most disastrous premieres and first weeks of any film in history. So bad that the critics were so laying for this film and the screening was so terrible, people couldn't hear anything, that United Artists ultimately pulls the film after a week in the theaters. And then about a year later, it was November of 80, April of 81, an hour and 149-minute version comes out, which is 2.5 hours. And that bombs even – nobody goes to see that. And the critics attack that even more because it's incomprehensible.
Yeah.
Now, to Heaven's Gate's credit, you know, Cimino came off of The Deer Hunter, winning all these Academy Awards. UA wanted to keep him happy. They wanted him. Walken, who had just gotten Best Supporting Actor, comes along, part of the package. And yet, you know, at the time, it was hated by everybody. You can see the film now in the 3-hour and 29-minute version, and the movie is certainly not a great film. It's a good movie. It's a good movie that's too long. It's an ambitious movie. It wants to be great. It's about politics. It's about a very small incident, but historically significant incident where in Johnson County, Wyoming, the cattlemen got together because of the wave of immigrants coming in and put together a death list and sent regulators, a.k.a. hired government-sanctioned mercenaries, to go out and kill immigrants who were stealing cattle. And so it is a classic range war movie, which we've had plenty of those in the history of the Western. But this is shot the way that, you know, if David Lean were making a Western. And so it's gorgeous and it has interesting moments, but it's really long.
This is from 1890, Wyoming. Okay, man. So you're going back and again. And the publicity, I remember at the time, the publicity was just deadly. Everyone slamming this film.
They were up there forever. They were spent, you know, the budget just kept going up and up. And,
Hollywood and, access and all that stuff.
And it was a great opportunity in the end because of the failure to sort of say, okay, this has got to stop.
Yeah.
The director is no longer going to be in charge of the picture. The studios are going to start to have more power as they're owned by the corporations, and the corporations, the studios are going to tell the directors what to do, not the other way around.
Well, what's the clip we have here?
So, and this is one of the early scenes with Sam Waterston, who is the head of the Cattlemen's Association, basically making his case for exterminating the immigrants.
This is no longer a poor man's country.
No.
These immigrants only pretend to be farmers. But we know many of them personally to be thieves and anarchists openly preying on our ranges. No jury in Johnson County will indict them, even in the face of evidence as conclusive as any ever offered in a court of justice.
Right. they're an ignorant, degraded gang of paupers. Their only stock in trade consists of having large numbers of ragged kids.
Out of 180 indictments we have had, one conviction in 4 years. That man was caught with the hide and the bones of the stolen animal. He was found guilty of stealing the hide and the bones only, which were valued at $18, making his crime petty larceny.
The jury evidently took it for granted that the rest of the animal was still out roaming the range.
Unenforced law is an invitation to anarchy. Consequently, the Stock Growers Association will now and publicly wipe out these thieves and anarchists. We are employing 50 men on the basis of $5 a day and $50 for every cattle thief shot or hung.
That's from Heaven's Gate, 1980, by Michael Cimino. What impact, you know, did that disaster have on his career and even the actors like Kris Kristofferson who were in this film?
Cimino went on to work again. He made The Year of the Dragon for Dino De Laurentiis and then sort of
faded away.
He made a couple of other pictures, but never really reached that level of grandiosity. And maybe, you know, maybe this is a film that isn't really a great director going bad. Maybe it's just an okay director who made an okay movie in the end.
Let's wrap up today with a film from the great Steven Spielberg. This is 1941 that was filmed in 1979, if you track all that. Hysterical Californians prepare for a Japanese invasion in the wake of Pearl Harbor. This is John Belushi, Dan Aykroyd, and a whole bunch more, Jason.
This starts off as a tiny little script called The Night the Japs Attacked, written by Robert Zemeckis and Bob Gale when they were at USC Film School. They go and are John Milius, their buddy, heads to Alabama with them, where Steven Spielberg is wrapping up Close Encounters of the Third Kind, and Spielberg says, I'm going to make a movie that's going to be, it's a mad, 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 mad world meets the Russians are coming, the Russians are coming, and it's going to be the craziest comedy everyone's ever seen. There was a famous T-shirt that was worn that was a quote by Spielberg that said, I will not make this movie if it costs 1 cent over $11 million. Final budget was $32 million of Columbia and Universal's money.
Wow.
Now,
wow.
He had made Jaws for Universal. He had made Close Encounters for Columbia. These were movies that minted money. Nobody was going to tell him no. So the movie grows and grows and grows as he gets this cast of 24 major names to star in it. Christopher Lee and Warren Oates and even, you know, small people showing up in, like, Patti LuPone in this tiny little role. But it's Belushi, it's Aykroyd, it's Tim Matheson. It's no secret and no surprise that he has two of the major names from Animal House. His buddy John Landis has this huge success with Animal House, and Spielberg's a little bit jealous. Mm. He sees that this little puerile comedy has made so much money, and he's like, I can outdo that. I can make a movie that's just as funny as Animal House, so I'm going to get the two biggest guys from Animal House. He also grabs Dan Aykroyd. He grabs John Candy. And each of these people has to have their character enlarged for them. Each of them has to have more screen time. So the script bloats and bloats and bloats and bloats. And here's the major problem. Spielberg is an expert at staging action and can do so better than anybody on the planet. He doesn't know comedy. And he says, I can't direct comedy. Now, you can look at a movie like Indiana Jones, which has a lot, Raiders of the Lost Ark, which has a lot of funny moments. That's not really directing comedy. When he does go a little bit broader in the comedy, such as in Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, it's not so successful.
Right.
So 1941 comes out, and it is gigantic in scale. It is epic in scope. And it's not really very funny at all.
What's the clip we have here from 1941?
Our clip here is actually one of the funniest parts. We have a lost Japanese submarine that is prowling along the California coast, and they want to bombard Hollywood with their deck gun. They're trying to find Hollywood, but their compasses are out. So they kidnap an American hillbilly played by Slim Pickens, and the name of his character is Hollis or Hollywood. So his name is Hollywood. They're looking for Hollywood. The Japanese captain is interrogating him.
Sneaky little bastards ain't getting doodled out of me except maybe my name, rank, and social security number. Wood. Hollis P. Lumberjack. Social security 106-432185.
Where Hollywood?
Right here.
What?
You're looking at him.
Who?
Hollis Wood.
Where?
I'm right here.
Shoot, can't you understand plain English?
Hollywood. Huh? Where? Here!
Oh.
it's funny. I like that bit.
Jason Heck, Mitch Bryan with today's show on great directors who made terrible films. Always good to have you
guys. Our pleasure.
Thanks so much for coming in.